You are listening to the Living Hope International Ministries Weekly Bible Teaching Podcast. For more information, visit us online at lhim.org.
All right, Psalm 1 is where I'd like to begin, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time in Psalm 1. I know you've already spent so much time in Psalm 1 and thinking about Psalm 1, but not everyone who is listening or watching right now has been part of the women's conference this weekend. So I just wanted to sort of include the others in the room and online in what's going on so they can kind of get on the same page here. So I'd like to read Psalm 1, and I'm reading from the NIV because it includes males and females in how they translated it. Seemed like that would be fitting this morning especially. But it says, "Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord," that's Yahweh there, "and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree." See, we have a nice picture of a tree here. Verse 3, "That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers." So that's the first half of the psalm where we hear about the righteous, the person who chooses to walk according to God's Torah, his law, his instruction, how God says to live, which depends on when you're living and what your situation is. And then the other side we see in verse 4, "Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction." So this is a very simple psalm. It's a Torah psalm. It's a psalm of orientation where things are working the way they're supposed to work. Now, of course, the Bible knows, just like you know, that there are exceptions in life where somebody follows God's way and then suffers. Exhibit A, Jesus. Right? Here's somebody who always did the righteous thing, always did correctly by God, and yet suffered a great deal as a result of how people treated him and whatnot. So there are obviously exceptions to this, but the general principle is clear. You do things the way God says to do them, you'll have a blessed life. You do things the way the wicked do them, and you're going to suffer as a result. So I don't want us to get hung up on the exceptions. You know, there are exceptions in life, but you know, you don't really want to base your whole life philosophy on the exception. You want to base it on what it is that is generally the case, and that's what we see in the book of Proverbs as well in this psalm here. And what I'm really interested in this morning is not if you're having a good, easy life and you're surrounded by righteous people and then you do righteous things. I think if that's your case, God bless you. That's wonderful. I would say nothing bad about that at all. It's just, I think that's so easy. So, you know, there's not really much to say there. I'm more interested this morning in the scenario where you're surrounded by people doing the wrong thing, and then you still choose to do the right thing. Or where you're in a life situation where everything is pressuring you to do something that God says is wrong, and then you still choose to do the right thing. So that's really what I'm focused on this morning. I think if you have an easy life, then I'm happy for you. This message is more for those who are struggling in situations or who are in family situations or being pressured at work by the wicked or wickedness of some sort and are struggling to choose the way of God. And so I have three examples for you. We're going to start in Genesis 16 as far as my first example. And we're going to look at Hagar, Abigail, and Jehoshabeat. So that's a good name. Oh, I got a who from the Bible college grad in the front row. That's a good sign. Means I'm doing my job. No, you're not. Okay. Well, You took some classes. You took some classes. All right. Well, we're going to start with Hagar. I've always called Hagar Hagar, but I learned recently that I'm supposed to say Hagar. And so there. But if I slip in an occasional Hagar, please forgive me. Okay? So anyhow, Hagar, Genesis 16, verse 1, we read about her life. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar, and Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, Yahweh has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." Sometimes our literal translations, this is the ESV, sometimes it's literal to the point of crassness. That's all I'm going to say about that. Going on, verse 3. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you." Wait a second. It's like one of those marital things where I feel like the guy's kind of the victim. I mean, I don't know if I can say that at a women's conference, but let's read it again. Verse 5. And Sarai said to Abram, after Sarai gave Sarai's servant to Abram and said, "I want you to..." Okay. "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May Yahweh judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. So this beginning start of Hagar's story, this is not really the beginning of her story. She was probably picked up in Egypt when Abram and Sarai had visited Egypt. If you remember, there was a little trip they made down there, and there was a kerfuffle with the Pharaoh, and he might have grabbed Sarai, and Abram might not have been very manly in that moment, and might not have defended her, if you recall, and just sort of like let her go. Real moment of dropping the ball in Abram's case. But he got her back, and when they left Egypt, that's probably when they got Hagar. We don't really know when she joined, but we know she's Egyptian, and we know that they were in Egypt, and we know she's a slave. So she probably was purchased at that time or given as part of the arrangement there to get Abram to leave and take his wife with him. But Hagar had been with the family for a time, and she is a very low-status person. She's as low-status person as you can get unless you were a kid. A kid slave would be even lower status than Hagar. So in the ancient world, you have this hierarchy of all these different levels, and everybody knows where they're at within the family. Hagar is at the bottom. And so she is told by Sarai. We don't know if Hagar agreed or disagreed. We don't really know much about her perception. But Sarai told her, "I want you to be with my husband because I can't have children. I want you to be a surrogate mother." Now, unless you think this was a strange practice, we have lots of ancient Near Eastern, well, maybe like five or so, ancient Near Eastern texts that talk about this practice from not just the Hebrew people, but also other peoples around the same time. It was standard operating procedure because they didn't have fertility medications or other ways of dealing with things, and you really needed to have children so you can pass down the inheritance. And so I don't think that necessarily makes it right, okay? But my point is, Sarai's not doing something weird or unusual here. She's following the culture of the time. And it's very limited what the people of God know at this point as far as right and wrong. They had not received the law yet. Jesus had not yet come. The Spirit was not yet poured out. I mean, these people lived before everything. And so they're doing what they're doing. And Hagar, let's all agree to this, she got the short end of the stick as far as all the arrangements, right? Because she got pregnant, which is good. That makes her kind of a superstar in the household. But then she got treated harshly and she fled. So she's now outside the family. She's outside of the protection. She doesn't want to go back. And she's pregnant too, on top of all of that. A tough situation, right? Can we agree to that? Let's go to the next section there, verse 7. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, and the spring on the way to Shur, just in case you want to visit there sometime. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going?" This reminds me of God in the garden saying, "Where are you?" Right? Like he didn't know. I think this angel probably knows what's going on, right? But you ask the question so that you can start the conversation and find out where she's at. She said, "I am fleeing from my mistress Sarai." Verse 9, the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her." The angel of Yahweh also said to her, "I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man." This is where it kind of takes a turn, okay? "His hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen." Verse 13, So she called the name of Yahweh who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing." For she said, "Truly, here I have seen him who looks after me." Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lahai Roi. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. To receive an angel visitation in the Bible is huge. Okay? I mean, there's just not that many of them. And when they happen, it's a big deal. Something's going on of significance. You know, like Mary saw Gabriel. Well, she was about to become pregnant with the Messiah. I mean, that's a big deal, right? So Hagar getting an angel visitation is a way of God saying, "I see you. And I'm doing something on your behalf." Right? Here is somebody that is really the last person you would expect to receive anything from God. She's super low status. She's just, and it's not clear exactly what happened there. Especially, you know, for us guys, we're at a loss to figure out what exactly is going on here when women are going at it. But Sarai says Hagar looked down on her, whatever that means, because now Hagar's pregnant. So maybe Hagar did it. I don't know. I'm going to plead the fifth or abstain from judgment on this case. But whatever it was, there was a situation. And you can see Sarai is very insecure, right? Because she doesn't have any children. Children are everything in their world. And Hagar just like even looks at Abram and now she's pregnant. Sarai's been trying for like 50 years. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, pent up frustration, I would imagine. But whatever. My point is, Hagar goes out to the wilderness and God sees her. And she sees God and she says, "You're the God of seeing. You have seen me, I have seen you." And it's not even really God, it's the angel. But the angel is God's representative who speaks on God's behalf. You understand that, right? What I find so, I mean, there's a lot to see here. I don't want to linger too long. But verse 10, she gets the Abrahamic blessing to her. You remember the Abrahamic blessing, the blessing God gave to Abraham? "I'll multiply you, I'll bless you and multiply you." Hagar gets that. It's like, what is going on here? And the kid's name, too, means God heard. Ishmael. So, verse 11, the angel of the Lord said, "Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael." So God, through the angel, names the kid. This is another huge moment. And then says, "Because Yahweh has listened to your affliction." God sees your suffering, Hagar, and God's going to take care of you. God's going to, you know, you might be the bottom of a long list of hierarchy, but God's going to lift you up to make you a matriarch, to make you somebody of great significance through this child. And then, you know, he's going to be a wild donkey of a man, verse 12. You know, I don't, there's not much I can say about that. But let's pick up the story in chapter 21. So Hagar goes back. Hagar goes back. Now, in this case, once again, the law has not been given. Jesus has not come. There's no Holy Spirit. So what is the way of the Lord? What is the way of righteousness for Hagar? It's the word spoken by the angel. And what was the word spoken by the angel? Go back and submit to Sarai, who's being a jerk. She's being harsh with Hagar. Maybe it was righteous, maybe it was unright. I don't know. I'm not getting in the middle of that. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I will tell you this. For Hagar to do the easy thing is for Hagar to just be like, you know what, I'm out, going back to Egypt. Going back to Egypt, or I'm going to go find some other clan nearby, and I'm going to join myself to that clan. That's the easy thing for her to do. It's just to say, you know what, I never even liked these people. I'm out. They treated me harshly, I fled, I'm out. That's the easy thing to do, right? That's walking in the path of the wicked. That's sitting with the scoffers, right? Just scoff at this family. They can't have kids. Scoff at them, right? But that's not what she does. She returns and she submits because she chooses to do the hard thing and walk in the way of righteousness. It's a powerful example. Powerful example. Look at 21 verse 15. Then the water in the skin was gone. Well, let me catch you up to this scenario. Time has passed. Hagar has given birth. And then years later, Sarai, of all people, the geriatric mother, somehow manages, obviously from a miracle of God, to give birth to this promised child. And there's much laughter. So they called his name Isaac, which means he laughs. Because it's hysterical. I mean, they know it. Like, Abraham laughs when God tells him. Sarah laughs. She's like, come on. But yet, there he is, walking around in a little ancient equivalent of a diaper. And wouldn't you know it, Ishmael laughs. And Sarai sees Ishmael, the older brother, laugh at Isaac. And he's not allowed to laugh. So Sarai says, well, by this time, she's Sarah. Whew, thank God. By this time, she's Sarah, and Sarah, the princess, says, nobody is going to be laughing at my son like that. And she says, I don't want this slave woman in my household, and I don't want her son as a potential heir. Get him out of here. And Abram, by now Abraham, he's just like, well, I really don't want to do that, because that's his boy. He loves him, but he decides to go along with it, and God's involved in the situation a little bit here. But once again, Hagar is on the run. Once again, Hagar is mistreated, and this time, Hagar didn't do anything. It's clear she's innocent. And we pick it up in verse 15. So she's out in the desert, and when the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. He's probably about 12, 13 at this point. Don't think of a little baby, but, a adolescent, young teen. Then she went and sat down opposite him, a good way off, about a distance of a bow shot, for she said, let me not look on the death of the child. Whew. And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept, and God heard the voice of the boy. That's what Ishmael means again, God heard. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? I don't know, angel. What do you think? Like last time, it's like, where are you going? It's like, I'm running away, duh. This time, she's so distressed and discouraged that she's convinced she's going to die and her precious boy is going to die. And so she's like, well, let me just put him over here and then I'll go over here. This way I don't have to watch him die. What's wrong, Hagar? Doesn't that seem a little funny to you? Where are we at here? Verse 17 again. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said, "What troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy, hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him into a great nation." Woo! Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew up. And he lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. God saw, God cared, God intervened, God made her like that tree. And the thing about a tree by a stream is that it can have water, it can be taken care of, it can be supplied, even when it doesn't rain for a long time. That's the advantage of having the stream there. If you're in the middle of a field, like the trees across the street here, if it doesn't rain for a long time, then you dry up. Your leaves turn brown. But Hagar is in the desert, and God brings her to water. And God takes care of her, and God makes her into a nation. All right, example number two, Abigail, 1 Samuel 25. Another interesting woman of the Bible, someone who did something that I call these all women of integrity. You know what integrity is? Integrity is doing the right thing even when it's hard. It's saying no when you should say no and saying yes when you should say yes because it's the right thing to do. That's what integrity is. Showing up on time is a simple thing, right? You say you're going to be at a meeting at a certain time. You say you're going to go to an interview or whatever it is. If you say it's going to be at that time and you show up at that time, you're somebody who has integrity because you're doing what you say you're going to do. That's a classic example of integrity. Of course, it's a lot bigger than that. 1 Samuel 25, we meet Abigail. And Abigail has a hard marriage. She's hitched. That's the term for married, right, Talia? Hitched her wagon? Well, to a bad horse. There it is. Thank you. I knew somewhere I'd find it there. I think we should have you in the front row more often. Usually over here, but, you know. Yeah, she hitched her wagon. Well, I don't think she had any choice. It was probably arranged by the parents, right? But she got hitched to a bad horse. He was more of a mule, to be honest, this Nabal. He wasn't even really a horse. All right. Verse 1, now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, for they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran, and there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful. Ooh, wouldn't you like that to be said about you? Discerning and beautiful. Not just good looking, but also knows how to handle herself. Knows how to make decisions. But the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So Abigail's discerning and beautiful. Nabal is harsh and badly behaved. Calebite probably means he was descended from Caleb, who had been a hero in that region, had done some really amazing things, real great courage. And so he might have had a great lineage, but, you know, he was bad. He was badly behaved, and he said harsh, right? Yeah. So, verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the men, "Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, shalom, right? And peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Word on the street is you have shearers. Now, your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." This is kind of a strange incident in the Bible. Not one of the more well-known incidents in David's life, But a lot of this deals with the culture of the time and the way reciprocity works, where somebody gives and then now they expect to receive in return for that giving. And I just wanted to read you a little quote from this this commentary I have. It's called the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary, or as I like to call it, the ZIBBC. And this is a little comment made by Phillips Long here. He says, shearing time in the spring was a time of abundance and gladness, and one would hope of generosity. If, as early second millennium texts from the Babylonian city of Larsa indicate, one sheep produced over 2 pounds of wool at shearing time, Nabal's 3,000 sheep would have produced over 3 tons of wool. Wool is not a heavy substance, right? Anybody got wool on today? Probably some of us are wearing wool and we're not like weighed down, are we? But to get 3 tons of wool, you've really gotta basically fill this room, right? I mean, it's really gotta get a lot of wool to make it that heavy, to make it that substantial. So there is a sense that this particular moment, this particular day that David sends these guys to ask this request, is like sending over somebody on, in our culture, Christmas Day. Or some other festive time where there's a lot, you know, like maybe July 4th and there's a barbecue in the backyard and you go over and say, hey, you know, I didn't get to go to the store. You mind if I, you know, join or get some food? And you know, you're looking at your backyard supplies and you've got way more food than you can use. Right, this is that kind of a scenario. Or for them, it was the time of the shearing, that there's this abundance, there's going to be slaughtering of animals, there's going to be partying and enjoying all of the benefits of all the hard labor. And that's the day when David sends these guys to say, hey, can you help us out? We don't have enough supplies, and we've been really helping out your shepherds. It's not exactly clear what David was doing. I don't think this is a mafia thing, just for the record. I don't think it's like, hey, you want some protection? And then the shop owner says, protection from what? And then you smack him, you say, from that. Right? I don't think this is that. I don't think David is opening like the early Hebrew version of the mafia 10 centuries before Christ. No, I don't think that's what's going on. I think what he's doing is he has done a service to Nabal without Nabal knowing about it. And so now he's telling Nabal, hey, can I be blessed by, can you share some of your wealth with me? And again, Nabal's like stupid rich, okay? He's not just like an average cat on the block. I mean, he's got a lot of extra. He does not need to be stingy at all. But verse 9, we read, when David's young men came, they said this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat? Notice my, that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where. So David's young men, verse 12, turned away and came back and told him all this. So this is the ancient equivalent of a snub. This is where you insult somebody who's asking for a request. Say, not only am I not going to do it, but I don't even recognize your master. Who is this guy? I never heard of him. There are a lot of people breaking away from their masters. It's almost like he has heard of him, and he knows that he's broken away from Saul, and David's out in hiding during this period. It's almost like he does know that, but he's trying to snub him harder by saying, I don't ever even heard of him. It's hard to say whether he knew him or not, but it is pretty clear that this absurdly wealthy guy is antagonizing David, because he thinks he's above him, he's putting him in his place. In verse 13, and David said to his men, this is David's response, very quick response. Every man strap on his sword. Go time. Right? Load up, boys. We're going to deal with this insult. Wow. How many men are there? Let's see here. And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. Whoa, I don't care how big your house is, Nabal. You got a 400-man, really angry army coming for you. And they have every reason to just go nuts when they get there. And what do we see happen? But verse 14, thank God for Abigail. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. And they were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. Nabal, this is like probably Nabal's best servant, you know, the person who really knows what's going on, because this is the one that knew what to do, was to talk to Nabal's wife, Abigail, about it, because she's a discerning person. She's somebody that knows how to weigh situations and figure out what to do in that situation. And she does not stop. She does not think about it. She just, boom, just like David, she jumps into action. Verse 18, then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of fig Newtons. Wow, I didn't know those were in the... I'm just kidding. Cakes of figs. That was just testing you to see if you're reading with me. And laid them on the donkeys. Raisins and figs and wine and bread. And basically she grabbed everything that she could quickly grab and threw it on these donkeys. And she's going to transport them over to David there. Verse 19, and she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. Woo! It's interesting, though, that he says male. He's not planning on killing everyone, just the guys. So at this point, Abigail's got a few options. I mean, she already had a few options before because her husband stinks. He's just a bad guy, right? And sometimes that happens. Sometimes you end up in a marriage where the other spouse just stinks, right? And Abigail says to herself, I'm going to intervene. I'm going to save the situation, save my husband, right? But she did not need to do that. She could have just stayed home and said, well, you made your bed, Nabal. Time to sleep in it. Because she knew that would provoke a reaction because she heard of David. Everybody heard of David. He killed Goliath, hello, you know, like you don't want David plus 399 other guys with strapped on swords buzzing around like bees looking to revenge their honor, right? That's not what you want. But Abigail chose to act, and then even when she got to David, she could have just said to David, David, go ahead. He's really no good. I've been living with him for so long, since I was of the age to marry. He's always been bad. He's never going to, just go ahead. Go ahead. I'm out of the house. Take care of him. She's like, here's another knife just, you know, to help. She could have done that, right? I think some of us would do that. We'd just be like, you know what? This must be the provision of the Lord. And just said, you know, I'm just going to give him this food supplies. Don't kill everybody, just strike the head of the snake and the rest of it will be fine. But that's not what she does. Verse 23, she does something so incredible. Now, just before I read verse 23, once again, this is an honor-shame society, which is why everyone's so amped up over just like being denied free food. And Abigail is a high-status person because she's married to Nabal. Nabal's a Calebite. And he's wealthy. He's very wealthy. He's got a lot of servants. And so Abigail is herself a high-status person. David is, at this point in his life, a very low status person. Now, David had been a high status person because he had been right there with the king, leading the army and everything else. But what happened? He had to run away and he was hiding out. So David is not, he's now a fugitive. He's on the lam from the government and he's hiding out. And if you get caught helping David, you're in trouble too, right? So David is like a untouchable kind of person in this scenario, whereas Abigail is the kind of lady that's got a couple of skins of wine full and ready to go, and 200 pieces of bread just like that if you need, just in case, right? How many pieces of bread you got in your house ready to go? How many baklava pans do you have ready to go, Christine? You know, I mean, Abigail's got it all ready. She's got the figs, and she's got the raisins. It's all set to go. She just loads it up and goes. That's the kind of person she is. And verse 23, this is why it's so amazing what she does here. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. And she fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt." Whoa. Two things. One, she calls him my Lord. This guy's a renegade. He's on the run. He's not her Lord. She's the Lord, and he is the one that needs to serve her. But she says, "My Lord," to him. She honors him in this huge way, and then she says, "On me be the guilt." This is somebody taking responsibility for the actions of her knucklehead spouse. And then she fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. I mean, this is like the most excessive level of humbling that you can have in their culture. Verse 24, she fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant." She's calling herself a servant or a slave. "Let not my Lord," verse 25, "regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." By the way, Nabal means fool. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Do you see how many my lords there were right there? That's the third one. That's the third my Lord in a row. Verse 26, "Now then, my Lord, as Yahweh," or the Lord, "lives, and as your soul lives, because Yahweh has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. For now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord." There's two more my lords there, right? And she just goes on like this. "My Lord, my Lord, my Lord, my Lord, my Lord." I counted 14 in the space of 9 verses. I mean, this is laying it on thick. And in the end, what David says to her, we'll have to skip down because of time. Verse 32, what David says to her is, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me." David recognizes in Abigail's assertiveness in the situation that Abigail is not just doing the honorable thing by her husband, by saving his worthless life, but she's also, David sees her as a messenger of God, that she has come as God's spokesperson to prevent David from doing something really bad. David should not strap on the sword of his 400 guys and go kill this rich guy just because he said no. That's overreacting. Can we agree? Yeah, just a little bit. Verse 33, "Blessed be your discretion and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand." Verse 34, "For as surely as Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to me truly by morning, there would had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." David was going to kill them all. And David took the supplies, and then Abigail goes home, and she gets home, and Nabal's having a party. He's so clueless about the whole thing. So he's having a party, and the Bible says it's a party, a festival fit for a king. Right? So and it says that he was so drunk that she was just like, we'll talk later. Right? So she waits till the morning, and it says, once the wine had gone out of him, a little crass again, but once the wine had gone out of him, she speaks to him, and she tells him what happened. And the scripture says that his heart became like a dead man. You know, like he was just like so in shock by how close he came to not only dying, but losing all of the men that work for him, and just being totally decimated by this really upset group of soldiers, right? And still, he lived for a little while. Still, he lived for a little while. It says in verse 38, if you could skip down to verse 38, and about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. I'm just saying, you know, like, God took care of it, right? I mean, when it comes to life and death and judgment, it's not really our department, is it? I mean, I guess in parenting, we got to do a little bit of that. But generally speaking, judgment is God's department. And God, you know, decided, all right, Nabal, that's enough. And he died. And Abigail was set free, and she ended up marrying David. We're going to look at our third example here before we completely run out of time. She ended up marrying David, and so her last husband was this worthless fellow who was just really harsh and just not a good example of what God wants from men. And then her second husband was David, who she married when he was at the bottom, right? He's running around in the wilderness. Like, it's not clear he's ever going to even survive, but then ends up becoming king, and not just king, but the greatest king of Israel's history. Whoa. Wrote 73 Psalms and did so many great things for God. Did some bad things. We don't need to get into that right now. But, you know, definitely God took care of her because she is a woman of integrity. She did the right thing, even when it was hard. 2 Chronicles 22 is Jehoshabeat, and not many of us are naming our kids Jehoshabeat today. Check the children's registry on the way in. Didn't have any Jehoshabeat signed up for the program upstairs today. Nevertheless, verse 10 here. Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal family of the house of Judah. Does anybody know who Athaliah's mother was? Yeah, Jezebel. And not a good example. Not a good example. And her grandfather was Omri. Omri is a great Israelite king. Very famous, had a dynasty. He was the one that built the capital in Samaria. So Athaliah comes from, you know, royalty in a sense, but also from Jezebel in another sense. And so she's sort of like convinced that she should be in charge. And she's also wicked. So that's a really deadly combination here, because what happens is her son dies. Her son's the king. He dies. And then she looks around and she says, am I going to let these losers rule? And she goes through the royal house and she kills all the male heirs. And she crowns herself queen of Israel. Pretty powerful lady, huh? And so verse 11, but Jehoshabeat, the daughter of the king, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons, who were about to be put to death, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Thus Jehoshabeat, the daughter of King Jehoram and wife of Jehoiada the priest, because she was a sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she did not put him to death. Now, look, anybody can do the right thing when it's easy. What about when the death squad is making its way through the royal palace, killing all the male heirs, and you're just like, what do I do? Well, if you're like Jehoshabeat, what you do is you risk your life to save this child, this baby, probably 1 year old baby. And she secrets him away and puts him in a closet or in a bedroom with the nurse, out of reach of the situation. But then the next thing that's so incredible, in verse 12, it says, and he remained with them 6 years. That's one thing in a moment to be courageous. It's another thing to raise a kid for 6 years. Right? We're talking diapers. We're talking, right, Peter? We're talking sleepless nights, right, Grace? And, you know, you've got all of the, you know, the joys and sorrows of raising a baby and then a toddler until he's 7 years old. And she does that. And, you know, so this is not maybe the most glorious example of, you know, what a woman can do or what a man can do. But it, boy, what a difference it made. What a difference it made. Look at verse 12 again. He remained with them 6 years, hidden in the house of God while Athaliah reigned in the land. And so she mothered this boy. And then when the time was right, her husband Jehoiada, who was a priest, gathered together some of the other soldiers and guardians of the temple, and they overthrew Athaliah when this boy was 7 years old and Joash became king. This was what protected David's lineage from breaking at this one very vulnerable moment in the history of the kings of Judah. If Jehoshabeat had not done this, the Davidic dynasty could have fallen. I mean, that's huge. That's huge. One act of courage by a woman of integrity who said, not only am I going to save this boy's life, but I'm going to take him in and I'm going to parent this boy. And guess what? Parenting the next king? That's a big deal. You teach him the difference between right and wrong. Guess what? That's what's going to become law in 6, 10, 20 years' time when he rules over the people. I mean, what an incredible influence this woman of God had, because she was willing to do the right thing. She was willing to follow the way of righteousness when there was literally swords swinging around in the house and people getting killed, blood splattered everywhere from all these male heirs that were getting slaughtered by this madwoman, Athaliah. She did the right thing, and because of that, she made a difference. And so that's my challenge to you today. My challenge to you today is to be a woman or a man of integrity, to be someone who says, I'm going to follow the path of righteousness, the way of God in this situation, even though there's pressure to do the other thing. All Jehoshabeat had to do was nothing. And she would have been fine. They weren't going after the daughters or the sister of the king. She was going to be fine. The moment she grabbed that kid and handed it to the servant and said, here, hide him away. The moment she did that, she put a big mark on her forehead. As if to say, if she gets caught, she's dead. And yet it was the right thing to do in that situation. And who took care of her? God took care of her. In the end, God made her like that tree, you know, that she would be taken care of. You don't think that this boy, Joash, who became the next king, took care of Jehoshabeat later on in life? Oh, yes, he did. With the full power of the entire government behind him. I mean, in the end, I think she probably had a really comfortable life, or a really secure life, at least. So this is our example today. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we ask that you would help us to be those who walk in your paths of righteousness, that even when times are tough, that you would give us the strength to follow what you say. And we're just so thankful for the example of your Son and for the power and indwelling presence of your Spirit, so that we would not be left to our own devices, but that we could do what it is that you ask us to do in this situation. And Father, I know that where we have fallen short in the past, it's easy to feel guilty, but I just ask for forgiveness for all of us that where we have fallen short, and help us to be your Jehoshabeat in the 21st century, to be your Abigail, your Hagar, your righteous person who does the right thing in our own time. I pray this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thanks for listening. Visit us at lhim.org, where you can access dozens of free classes, Bible teachings, and articles. Also, when you visit lhim.org, subscribe to receive email updates so you won't miss out on upcoming events. Until next week, keep loving God and your neighbor.